You're listening to The Path with Brad Wetzler. This is episode 1 featuring BK Lauren.
Okay, hello. This is The Path and I'm Brad Wetzler. And welcome to episode 1. And I'm happy to be here and I hope you're doing okay. It's been strange times and it's now mid-February, and not only are we in the middle of a pandemic, but we've got snowstorms and ice storms running across the U.S. and power outages, and I hope you're doing okay out there, and I hope you are staying connected with friends, staying connected with whatever you do to stay connected with yourself. And I'm just excited to be here and to introduce this new podcast and platform to talk about transformation, storytelling, personal growth, how we live a good life. All these things are things I think about a lot, spend time reading about, listening to other podcasts about, and I've got some great guests scheduled for the next several episodes, and I hope you will stay around and bear with me as I get my sea legs to create something new, something I've never done before. And my goal is to keep it real and keep it positive, and also get serious and look into issues that affect us all on this path of life, on this journey we're all on. You know, I guess one of the things that got me interested in doing this podcast was my own journey inward over the last several years, a journey inward through spiritual practices and meditation and yoga and contemplation and even travel to India and other places that inspired me to go on an inward journey. And then the pandemic hit, and it was really a great time to go further inward, I think, for me anyway. And but then as the last months of the year happened, and the election, and of course the full scope of the Black Lives Matter issues, and just really realizing that going inward isn't always enough. It can be even self-absorbed. And so I found myself once again paying more attention to the news and to the changes happening in our country. And I guess it inspired me to create this podcast that is really an exploration of both the inner path and the outer path, and looking at how those are connected, how they're related. I guess I kind of think about them as almost like a double helix, like a DNA strand they kind of circle each other, and to live a good life, to be a responsible adult, to be making impact in the world. I think we've got to do both. We've got to keep exploring our inner terrain, doing the things that keep us centered, that keep us mentally, physically, spiritually sound, and then also to then step into the world in a way to make decisions and lead our lives, and maybe lead others in a way that that brings forth this inner solidness and spirit that we develop in our inward path. So that's what I'm into here, and I'm going to be bringing a wide array of guests from different backgrounds, from my own background as a writer and journalist, but also, you know, people from the sports world, people from politics, people from the spiritual world, and who knows what else. But I'm hoping to kind of see how the things I care about intersect with these other thought leaders, other people out there who are writing, leading, and making impact in the world. And and just see where the rub is and see what we can find in common and maybe where we don't, and see where we can grow from that. And so I'm excited for my first guest for episode one, BK Lauren. BK is an author, a novelist, essayist, a teacher, and also a dear friend of mine. And we often bounce ideas off each other. So I thought it was really, really appropriate. And I'm grateful that she agreed to come on today and to talk about a number of issues. But some of the things that are dear to her heart are nature, and especially sort of where we find ourselves right now in our connection with nature, in what some people call the Anthropocene, which is a time in history that we've never had before, when humans have had such impact on the world that we've almost passed a point of no return, and there's almost very little nature left in its essence. And so BK is going to talk about that, talk about what's a healthy relationship with nature versus maybe what we sometimes bring to it in a codependent way of viewing nature and being in nature. And, BK is a great writer and storyteller, and we'll talk about stories and the transformative value of stories and how we change as human beings. And we'll talk also about some of the unnameable, the things that we are in our lives, in our hearts, in our path that maybe we don't have names for and yet are really at work in our lives and affect us in ways that maybe we aren't even aware of. So without further ado, here's BK Lauren. BK, hello.
Hey, Brad, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing today?
It's really good to see you. I'm doing great today, actually. How about you?
Good. I'm doing well. I'm in Austin, Texas today. I'm here for a little while, and it's really warm and sunny out after being in Colorado during a pandemic all winter. So it feels like very much like spring here, which I know is sort of maybe jealous inducing, but
I don't know. I'm hearing some birds out there.
Whenever are you? Yeah.
I'm hearing the sounds of spring. Yeah.
Good.
No spring yet. Thank God.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, so have you been out walking and riding your bike?
I went out this morning and it was, the wind was really bad, but I walked this morning to get a massage.
Nice.
And then I walked home. And so that was pretty sweet.
Well, good. When I return, we'll resume our walking out by the reservoir. So, well, thank you for being here. The things that have brought me to want to do this podcast are sort of questions I have in my own mind about living a good life, about, can we change, can we grow? What do we have to do? It seems to me, I've learned, maybe late in life, maybe right on time, that living out your living out who you are without doing much self-reflection, without doing much inner work, is a recipe for kind of disaster, in our lives. And that especially when we reach a certain age, so to speak, we've been running on patterns that maybe helped us survive childhood, maybe helped us survive our early professional lives, but maybe they don't work that well anymore. And I know personally I had to do a lot of recalibrating, a lot of inner searching to look at how I was showing up in the world and why. And I've been on maybe a 10-year journey of kind of looking at these things. And I humbly would submit that I am showing up in my life better than I used to. And I think I have a long way to go too. It just got me fascinated about all these issues, and I thought you would be just an amazing first guest on my podcast to talk about some of this stuff. And
Thank you.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think I'm particularly interested in you as a, as someone who knows, has been in nature a lot, who's written a lot about it, thought a lot about nature, spent a lot of time in nature, and also who's, you know, an expert in storytelling. And so those are the two things I wanted to really go deeper into today, and also to see what else might come up between us. But I thought we'd start out with this, the topic of nature, and maybe what I'll kind of set it up by saying, you know, it's obvious when you read the news, when you look at you look, watch the news, you see, you know, forests burning, you know, here and abroad, you know, you see animals dying, you see, you know, storms ravaging the parts of the country that weren't used to it. So I guess I wanted to ask you, you know, are we beyond the point of no return with, you know, what we've done to nature? But then I also want to talk to you about what ways there is to still show up in nature, for ourselves in nature. So let me just kind of stop there and I'll see what you have to say about that, and I'll kind of guide you further down that path.
Sure. Well, if we're talking about the ways that we change and the things that transform us, I would have to say that I have like maybe three transformational points that seem very clear in my life. Most of them revolve around nature in some way. I'll touch upon those, and then maybe we can explore them singularly. Depending on where we go from there. But I lived in Los Angeles when I was what I call the Wonder Bread age, you know, when you're sort of forming yourself. And I would go anywhere to see a piece of green. And there was a little patch of land, and it was the only green that I could find. And I would just go there and just sit and just, you know, I was born in Colorado, and we lived in Colorado for a long time, and I just really wanted to get back to Colorado. I really wanted to get out of what didn't feel like nature to me. And I met then a man who was doing what's called animal forms. And animal forms are the basis of martial arts. And I don't know if that's common knowledge or not, but all martial arts began with watching animals in nature. And so when you do that, you become an animal. And a good teacher will be able to see the animal that you are. And then you learn the animal that you are, and you balance that with the animal that you're the opposite of. And so I studied with this teacher from when I was about, 11 or so. And that's the way that I first got in touch with nature. Was I was in a very urban place looking for anything. This man taught me, he was a Chinese man who had, well, I won't go into his story yet, but he taught me various animal forms. And I felt myself sinking into who I was through that. And really, even in an urban environment, I could feel the nature of that environment. I continued that study for a long time. I continued until I eventually moved back to Colorado. And continued learning various animal forms and continued martial arts and such. And then I had a period during that, this is sort of my second transition period, where I had like a series of dreams that really woke me up to to the presence of nature that's a deeper kind of nature, I would say. I felt during that time like I kind of was on the path to understanding the world and who I was. And that lasted until I was maybe in my 40s. And then I hit my 50s and I went, oh man, I don't know anything. And that's the point when you're supposed to know something. And this is a strange story, I suppose, but I took an environmental literature class. I mean, and I write what I think is environmental literature. And it was at a university. And I'm telling you what, I don't know anything that they were talking about in the class. And I felt so alienated. And I felt so relieved when I went to the environmental literature conference. And I don't know if you know the wonderful writer, Linda Hogan, Chickasaw writer. Mm-hmm. She was the honored guest at this conference, and she sat and I used to know Linda. Linda and I used to be friends, and I didn't think that she would remember me. She sat in the back of the room and didn't participate the whole time. And the third day she got up and she said, "Nobody knows what anyone in this room is talking about. You're all out of touch with nature." And she pointed to me and she said, "Do you remember Grandmother Eagle?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And that is the first time that I went on this sort of intellectual bypass of nature for a while, where I kept wanting to understand what academia was doing with nature, and a lot about the Anthropocene and that sort of thing. And I went off track for some time. And in that moment, when Linda pointed at me and said, "Do you remember Grandmother Eagle?" I said, "Yeah." And she said to everybody in the room, "Nobody cares what you're talking about. Only the people in this room care what you're talking about. And this is what matters." And then she read this incredibly beautiful poetry. That got me back on the track of who I am, and back on the, oddly enough, one of my animal forms is the snake and the hawk. And the image that you incorporate in your body when you're doing the snake and the hawk is sort of like the Yeats poem. I always think of it as, you know, so the snake coils up from the ground and the hawk spirals down from the earth, and they meet in the center of who you are in that moment when you're doing that form. And you transform between the earth and the sky throughout that form. And it's one of my favorite forms. It feels very much like home to me. Mm. And so I came back to that, and Linda helped me quite a bit with that. So
great story. Yeah. You know, what comes up for me as you tell that story and go through that is, maybe just how much I've learned about that growth actually comes from deconceptualizing. And I guess I don't want to take us too heady of a place here, but, you know, I think we become thinkers for a lot of complex reasons. And so often, you know, we live in a culture of thinking a lot too, I think. And I guess what I'm getting at is this need to strip away the layers of conceptualizing we can do that take us out of directly experiencing something like nature or experiencing ourselves. And so, yeah. So after this change of mindset, then how did you move forward, and how did that change? Did you return to a sense of a previous sense of nature, or did you kind of cultivate a new kind of a third way? And what happened next?
I'm still in the process of that. And I'm glad about that, because I don't want to understand everything at my age. I'm glad that I began at the beginning again, in many ways. And so, of course, I have a different relationship with nature, because we as a culture have a different relationship with nature now. It's changed quite a bit from... Well, we continue to destroy it. We've always been destroying it, and we continue to destroy it, and we continue to try not to destroy it. So now, on top of it being an intellectual thing, it is also a political thing. So there's so many layers that can separate you. It's also a thing of commerce now, a thing of identity. And I like to strip away all of those if possible. And I think that there's a danger right now where we go into nature and we carry commerce with us. We carry our egos. So it's so hard. I don't want to sound like I know anything more than anyone else, but I worry that it is commodified no matter what now. And I worry about when we talk about going into nature, I worry that what we see first is a commodification and all the gear we have to bring and all the, and what I really want us to, or myself to understand is that when I walk outside the door, I'm in nature. Mm. Even in Los Angeles, I could find it. And we have to be able to find it, recognize, because it's there, it's everywhere. And we, in order to save it, we have to be able to find it where we are. Mm. And that does not take a politic or an identity or any gear at all. Now, if you want to do that, that's wonderful and that's great. But it certainly can't be the only thing, you know. It can't be the only way that we go into nature. It can't be going into nature, quote unquote. We are a part of nature. Mm. And, you know, we have to be able to see it everywhere. The other thing that it does, if we talk about going into nature, it creates an us and them, you know, mm-hmm. because there are certain people who can't go into nature. They don't have the money, the time, and they're urbanites. And so it's a tremendous privilege to say, well, I'm going to go into nature now. Well, what if we flipped that and said, you know what, it's right here. Let's look deeper into, we have this sense of breadth in our culture. It'd be really nice if we learned some depth, because you can either learn a lot about the world by traveling, or you can learn a lot about the world by staying in one place and studying that place until you know every single aspect of it. The world is like a, you know, it's layered with all this knowledge, mm-hmm. and nature's there for you right now, no matter who you are or where you are.
How, for the person who lives in the suburbs, who, you know, realizes, and I did see this headline last week that was both kind of interesting and shocking and weird, but this headline said, you know, 2 hours in nature a day, is this the next 10,000 steps? And right. 10,000 steps, of course, if you haven't heard of that, refers to this idea that, you know, for a good, healthy health, you need to take 10,000 steps a day. And that, of course, led to the commerce of people buying Fitbits and monitoring their steps and all of that. So it was both interesting to see that headline, but like, that's the next quick fix to our health, is to spend 2 hours in nature. But I guess I want to ask, how does someone who lives in the suburbs think about their walks, and how can they, are they in nature? I mean, if they're walking around with green lawns and that sort of thing, then can they get something from that experience of walking through their neighborhoods, or the healing?
Are we animals?
Yeah.
We've created that. These are our abodes. Are they in nature? So, I mean, if I'm going to go back to the Anthropocene for a minute, there's nothing that's nature anymore. So it's a little bit like Taoism and Zen to me. So Zen believes in focusing on nothingness, and Taoism believes in focusing on everythingness. They're both the same thing, right? So so is there no nature anymore, as the Anthropocene would say? As there isn't anything that humans have not changed or altered. So if we're talking about nature as a pure thing that is completely unaltered, it's no longer available to us. It's not. So to live that as a lie creates an us and them and creates a privilege for those who can fake like they're going to go into nature when it doesn't exist in that way anymore. It exists as a symbol of itself or something. Mm. And so is it that we have no nature, or is it that everything's nature? So when I sit, currently I live in a place that has a lot of nature, but I just moved here 2 months ago. But I used to sit in my backyard in the middle of suburbia, houses all around me, and I would watch the birds. And we had birds and snakes. See, I like the earth and the sky. Mm-hmm. We had garter snakes, and I could hear the garter snakes in my backyard. I could hear them crawling. And I loved that. I knew where the snakes were going to be every day. People think that animals are just kind of random and they go, well, they have homes. And then, I ran into somebody the other day who she was frightened of a coyote on open space. And I said, well, why don't I walk with you until you get to your home, and I'll, so that you feel safe. And in the process of walking with her, she said, well, are they going to move the coyotes? As if they're objects, but animals have their homes and they have their ways. So in my little space in my backyard, I knew where that snake would be. I know when it would be there. I knew when the bird would be there. And so that depth of knowledge excites me just as much as if I go on a week long, I like bike packing rather than backpacking, because I like to think in circles, and that's why mm-hmm. I like cycling. I think in circles, and I could go on a week bikepacking and feel like pretty much exactly the same thing as when I sit and I watch a bird. It's an inside job. Mm-hmm. Seeing nature and being in nature is an inside job. It's not out there that's going to fix you. It's not your 10,000 or your 10,000 steps or your 2 hours. It's not out there. It's mm-hmm. not out there. I learned that early on when I was looking for nature in Los Angeles, and I found out that I was a bird. And in order to balance my energy, I had to learn to be a bear. And it's all there. There's a wilderness inside of us.
Mm. Say more about that.
It's the greatest wilderness, untouched area. It literally is a wilderness inside of us. Unless, there are forests in us. We have mites on our eyes. We are a forest. Mm. You want to look at nature, realize all the microbes that live on you, that you are this creature that holds things, And our inability or our unwillingness to see that will always separate us from nature, regardless of whether or not we walk, 25 days into the wild, what we call the wild now. But if you can feel that inside of yourself, then you can see it everywhere. You can see it everywhere.
Yeah.
I think.
A term, I would never forgot this term I read in a philosophy class years ago, but mysterium tremendum, and the idea of sort of like beholding the awfulness and awesomeness, and, and awesome often is brought up in the terms of like some spectacular looking over a cliff's edge or something, where you experience it all, the beauty, the majesty, the tragedy, the danger, the violence, the all of it in one kind of gasp. And I guess, you still hear people having experiences like this in nature, maybe encountering an animal too, I guess. Can what about these sort of transcendent experiences that one might have while traveling through nature? I'm just opening that up to you.
I you don't leave them behind when you leave nature. If they're transcendent and they transform you, then you bring them home with you. Mm. The again, I'll go back to the problem is that we have constant partial attention right now. And so we're always thinking that we have to go out to get something. So if you have a transcendent experience in nature, then you have access to that experience constantly in your life. It's your option whether or not you choose to answer the phone when it rings instead of listen to that experience. It's always there once you have it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had those, and I feel like time is layered. It's not linear. And so if it's layered, then those are still accessible to you at any mm-hmm. point. We were talking about the deer story earlier today, and I'll paraphrase the deer story.
I would like you to read it if you wouldn't mind. Could you read it for us? Yeah.
And I'll follow it up though, because there's a second part to it. I'll read this. This is from a book published a long time ago by me called The Way of the River. So this is, I'm just going to start sort of in the middle here. I was, I used to go and do animal forms what is now Evan G. Fine Park, but it wasn't Evan G. Fine Park then. It was just some red rocks. So I used to go up there and I'm in the middle of doing a deer form. It's called, in martial arts, there are internal and external forms, and I was doing the internal deer form. I used to run up there and I would take off as many clothes as I possibly could and then do the animal forms. So I stepped forward slowly, lifting my hands, looked over my left shoulder as the deer form requires. I repeated the movement, the world around me taking on a kind of blur, which suddenly came into focus. In front of me stood a herd of deer. It's not uncommon for deer to come dramatically close to you in the foothills of Boulder. They know they're safe, even though humans are everywhere. I noted them, and I kept doing the deer form, which felt playfully enriched by their presence. As I continued, however, the grazing deer moved closer and closer to me until eventually I was surrounded by them. The lead deer was no more than an arm's length away. I could easily have reached out and touched her nose. It did not feel playfully enriching to me anymore. For a brief moment, I was frightened. Deer are not predators, but they are wild. I once saw a film of a doe attacking a grown man. He did not fare well. Sometime earlier, I'd had to place myself between a mother deer and my dog, who had unwisely chased her fawn. That deer was not Bambi. My fear waned, however, when I realized that I'd done nothing to threaten the territory. I'd been here moving slowly, sometimes standing very still, and they had come to me. So I relaxed, and as if they were not there, I continued the form. Before I finished the next move, however, I heard a strange sound. I'm familiar with the birds of the Colorado foothills, and I can identify most of them by their songs. The sound I heard was a pinched sort of squeaking noise, like a nuthatch, but more drawn out than the nuthatch's peeps. It was connected, sustained, resonant. I continued the form, but I scanned the ponderosa pines and junipers looking for a migrant bird. When the sound came again, however, my ears led me back down to the ground. I looked straight in front of me and noticed the throat of the doe moving. I focused on it. The noise sounded, the deer's throat moved, a direct correlation. Her eyes were looking straight at me, close enough that I could see the space between her eyelashes, the small notch cut out of her left ear in the shape of a tiny shark's tooth. She was moving toward me, slowly, making the odd noise as she approached. Now I held just one position of the deer form because I could not really move any farther without virtually nuzzling the doe. I studied the sound. It came from way back in the deer's throat, and was squeezed up through her vocal cords, though I didn't know that deer had vocal cords at the time. Likewise, I squeezed the muscle in the bottom of my throat, and a sound that started in my diaphragm carried upward. I imitated the resonant squeaking the deer made. As the sound reached the doe's ears, she cocked her head. Her ears twitched. I did it again, and this time she responded with a sound that seemed the same pitch and length of mine. She added a few notes at the end, which I repeated back to her. She cocked her head, took a step or two closer to me, my heart pounding until she stopped. She was close enough to me now that I could feel her warm breath on my wrist. Again, she made the sound. The other does had gone back to feeding, but they had not wandered far enough away to make me seem other than them. So there I stood, completely still, in the middle of a herd of deer, carrying on what seemed very much like a conversation with a large doe. If I can, I'll read a little bit of what happened after that. After that, should I go on?
Please, yeah. Yes, please.
After that, I was in school at the time, and I had a Greek test, and I had to go translate Greek. So I sat there translating from Homeric Greek, a language neither I nor anyone in our century had ever truly heard spoken accurately. And I was trying to capture the sound of the original in English, a language whose origins in me I could not remember, but which had seemed to shape the world before I had a chance to comprehend that world fully, experientially. It presented in me a paradox that is perhaps all too theoretical and drab to reiterate here. But the bottom line is, for whatever reason, I entered another language. My experience on the mountain earlier that morning was transformed. As soon as I entered this other language, Homeric Greek, which doesn't exist, nobody can hear it. We think we know what it is. That was no different to me than sitting and talking with this deer. The experience I had so easily discounted replayed itself now. This time it was not mind-bending. It was not extraordinary. It was what had happened. A deer had approached me. I had entered the ordinarily languageless space between humans and animals, and I had found there a sort of tenuous bridge. I'll stop there, I think, but I will say that I then went to the museology department, where I knew the man who works with animals, who taxidermied animals, had worked a lot with deer. And I said, have you ever heard a deer make a noise, or does a deer make a noise? And he said, well, yeah, but you'll never hear it. And I said, well, what kind of noise? And he said, well, you'll never hear it. And he said, there's tail, you know, that it will make a squeaking noise when it's talking to its young. Well, my dog is squeaking right now.
Yes, I heard that.
You hear that?
Yeah.
So I said, when it's a mother doe will do that when it's speaking to its young. And I walked away, and I knew that I had had a conversation. I was the baby deer. So to update that just a moment, not long ago, I was riding my bicycle in.
Is your dog dreaming?
Yeah. she's twitching, and she's she's agreeing with me.
Totally.
She's saying some things. So anyway, so I was riding my bike, and I saw a mother deer and two baby deer. And so I stopped. Well, this is Boulder, and so somebody had to get his Strava time down, and he ran just as fast as he could, right through the middle of the deer on his bike. And I went, oh, separated the mother from the baby. Now the baby was way over here, and the mother was way over here, and the mother started calling to the baby with the exact same sound that I heard that day. And the baby started answering, and I still have it on video. And I heard them talking in the same way that I felt, as if I was talking to the deer that day. And this was 20 years after the original experience, and I witnessed it. It was really
so. I hate to even try to draw a tidy lesson from that, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I mean, what did you come away with from that experience? And then maybe, and now, what, how do you think back on it?
Oh, what do I take away from
it? Let me rephrase that. Like, when you went home that night, what did you think had just happened? Answer that first, if you would.
I almost want to read part of that again, but
yeah,
I won't.
Please do then. Yeah.
No. Let me sit with this and answer it. Here. So, you mean what did I do after I went home that night?
What did it feel like had just happened?
It felt like I had a conversation with the deer, and it felt like that conversation wasn't translated into words, nor did it need to be in order for me to understand it, because words, they simultaneously all offer too little and too much, and they don't find the balance between very often.
Mm.
And only in that nonverbal space that, for instance, you might have with your dog, is there a clarity that exists before we name it.
Mm.
And that clarity is visceral. It's in your body. And that's what I mean about there's a wilderness in your body as well. I mean, that clarity is visceral. And once we try to name it, it will go away. It will go away.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't get it right. I mean, you can't get it right. It is already. We are not comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
We are just not comfortable with that. In order for something to exist, it has to be named. It has to be concrete. And in fact, the things that are most real to me, and I'm guessing to everybody, are things that you can't name them. And you can't say, what happened there? You know, what's love?
Right.
You know, what's the things that we enjoy the most, we lose our minds to.
Mm-hmm.
And that feel the most present. So how did I feel that night? I felt like myself.
Hmm.
And there are not a lot of times in your life when you can feel like yourself. Really.
Well, I guess I keep wanting to come back to this idea of stripping the concepts away from things, which is seems like we're just so haunted by mm-hmm. our own brains and our own concepts that we end up in little cages around. We put nature in cages and we end up in a cage when we even think or enter nature, it seems like, or enter any pursuit. And I guess I thank you for sharing that story, and I'm moved by it. And
dinosaurs had little tiny brains and big bodies, mm-hmm. and they went extinct, and we got big brains and little tiny bodies, and we're heading that direction.
yeah well, and you know, we start out talking about making, you know, spirituality as our lives and cutting away. And I think one of the things I'm very aware of is the more we talk about spiritual things, the further away from spirituality that I feel I get. And so I guess the story is so moving on many levels of, you know, hearing this experience you had. But then I also wanted to ask you then about rendering it into a story.
Mm-hmm.
How do you tell me about storytelling and writing about an experience like that and staying embodied, staying true to the story, staying without losing yourself in the head again in these concepts, and talk about storytelling for a bit. You are, you know, a master storyteller, and talk about rendering truth in story.
Well, I don't think I'm a master of anything yet, thank God. I hope I'm still on the path. And so, but I do, I love story, and story relates to nature because nature is always in process and story is always in process. And if you see a, let's go back. How do you write about that? I think the only things worth writing about are things that cannot be spoken. And I think people make a mistake when they want to write about things that can be spoken, things that they've already named, things that they already understand. I don't think that anyone has any business putting pen to paper to things that they already understand. Now, a journalist, yes, but a journalist is not, it's a whole different thing that we're talking about. And I respect journalists, and we need them. And they are truth tellers of the political world and of a world that is truly outside. It has, you know, we need to understand that world too. We live in it. And so we need that. I'm talking about a different kind of writing now, though. I'm talking about the kind of writing that, that, you know, a novel is or a memoir or something like that. All writing is artful. So I'm not going to say that one's more artful than the other, but they have different goals. And the type of writing that I do and the type of writing that I like to read for pleasure, not for knowledge, is, I don't think that you should put pen to paper if you think you understand it already, or if you think that you have something that you really want to say, because that's your ego sitting on top of some words and it wants to convince other people about things, you know, and, oh, if only other people could read this, they'd finally understand me. Well, you know, maybe you should understand you first. Mm-hmm. And then understand that the lack of understanding is in fact what moves a person forward. I mean, and so when people buy a book, my novel from me, and the novel is called Theft, and I don't know them, my regular inscription is that, explanation is the thief of awe. That's what I write in the book. Mm. And so, we go towards, because we're such a heady culture, we go towards things that we understand and that we know, and we're very proud of those things. I'm very interested in the things that we can't explain. I'm very interested in the things that you don't know about yourself. I'm very interested in those things because therein lies discovery, and therein lies the sense of awe that can bring you back to life. You know, we are missing what we are looking for when we go into nature is a sense of awe. And it is everywhere if you look for what is not named. It is everywhere, that sense of awe. We don't understand everything yet, thank God. And so that's what story is to me. Story is starting out with not knowing and getting closer, circling around what can't be said. To me, the story should always circle around what can't be said. Mm-hmm. And doing that, it has a tremendous power. I didn't try to understand that deer in the story. I just said to people, I was translating Homeric Greek, and I realized that was a language nobody heard. And this is a language nobody's heard either. And both of them are beyond us in a beautiful way. So I didn't try to say, oh, you know, that deer did this and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never, you know, people say, and nobody's really ever asked me either. I tell people, well, I had a conversation with a deer. And nobody who is a sincere person, nobody ever said, oh, yeah, what did the deer say to you? They don't want to know. They don't want to know. They want to know the process that I had a conversation with a deer. That's the process. The extent to which we as a culture don't value process is extreme. you know, and so we don't value, for instance, a writer when they're trying to become a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And we might mow down a tree if it's this big, but it'll be one. It'll, you know, it's in process. And we don't look at the beginning process as valuable. We don't look at the misunderstandings and the lack of understandings and all that stuff where that wonderful discovery is. That's where, you know, whenever I am teaching, I say this to my students. I look at my students and I wish I were them. I wish I were in that place again, that place where everything was unknown, where I didn't understand story quite as much. So my challenge to myself now is, how do I stay in that place? And I do stay in that place by changing what I write about, by always writing what I don't know, always writing what I don't know.
And reminds me of
two different forms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I know some people will stay in the same form and I'll do different forms as often as possible.
Yeah. I think we'd all do well to just admit we don't know more often, you know? I mean, I don't know, you know? I mean, I always think about, you know, scientists, for example, who I have a lot of respect for. And you know, science is such a crucial part of you know, the way that we've come to understand ourselves and the world and improved our lives in some ways and maybe not in others. But how certain we get, whether you're a teacher of writing or you're like a biologist, we get so attached to the reductionist way of thinking, and they forget, like, how many surgeons or what, you know, how many surgeons do you know that, like, remember that our bodies are energy and quantum physics is at work. Everything becomes about what we need to get through, I guess, the moment and to survive, but then we forget the mystery of it all so often. Yeah. And I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Objects, you know, but interestingly enough though, scientists do have to begin with, I don't know. Otherwise their experiments won't work.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, maybe that's a good moment to wrap this up. I guess I, you know, I love this talking about the unnameable and the importance of that. And is there anything else you want to add to this idea of honoring the unnameable? And maybe that's circle back to the nature and honoring when you walk out into nature, maybe we should just lose our concepts as much as we can and say, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know where I end and nature begins. For instance. And so maybe we can't walk out into nature. Maybe it's here, you know,
yeah.
Maybe, it really has to do with how much discovery you want to carry and how much you want to let go. In order to have a discovery, you have to let go of knowledge that you have,
mm-hmm.
you know, because then it's just a confirmation of the knowledge you have. That's not a discovery. So you have to constantly be in a place of not knowing in order to figure out, in order to have awe. And awe is what we're looking for in that 2 hours.
Yeah.
That you know, that you talked about earlier. Is that
right, yeah.
1,000 steps. If you name it nature, you're not going to find it.
Mm.
You know, but where it's the way you walk, it's not where you walk.
Mm-hmm. That sense? That's beautiful, and that's a great place to end, I think, BK. So thank you for being my guest today and for sharing your wisdom and your stories and your love of nature and love of storytelling, and I'm just in awe of you, BK. So thank you for being here.
Wow, that was interesting and powerful and enlightening. And thank you, BK Lauren, for being my first guest on episode one of The Path. And when I think about that conversation, I'm I guess I was really moved by her discussions of the unnameable and these feelings we can have, these impulses, these places in our bodies that are at work in us and that don't really have a name for them in English. And also her views on storytelling and nature. I just always get so full of new ideas when I talk to BK. And thank you for being here for episode one. And again, thank you, BK, for being my guest. And I'll see you next week. And I hope you all stay safe, stay warm, wherever you are. Wherever you are in the U.S., it seems like it's cold right now. So just pull in and lean on your friends and families, and we'll get through this. We'll get through the pandemic, and I'll look forward to seeing you next week. So take care. This is Brad Wetzler on The Path.